next case is 061749, Nancy Stoner versus Allstate Insurance Company. Mr. Heffel.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the appellate will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The issue is, in an uninsured or underinsured claim, always a contract claim for the purposes of determining prejudgment interest under Revised Code 1343.03. In 1994, Moskovitz traced the history of the common law, the case law, and prejudgment interest, and made the observations that in contract, prejudgment interest is to make the party whole. In tort, it is to punish delay. These principles were incorporated in 1983 in the amended Revised Code 1343.03. And in 1998, this court considered the application of that statute to a claim pertaining to UM coverage. In Landis versus Grange, the court determined that in that case, the claim for UM coverage was a contractual claim. The trial courts were given broad discretion to determine when the money was due and payable. In this case, the claim was for UM tort damages, not a question of coverage. This was a civil action to determine damages tried to a jury and was based on tortuous conduct of an uninsured or underinsured motorist.
Mr. Heffel, could you help us with a little more of the factual background? I saw in the briefs that the plaintiff settled with another
carrier for UM coverage under a Scott Ponser claim.
With consent of, did the tortfeasor have insurance?
No.
So it was tried. Who represented the tortfeasor when it was tried?
I represented, in essence, Allstate for the tortfeasor, the uninsured motorist.
Okay, so and your client was the carrier for the plaintiff.
Yes.
So your insurance company
insured Mrs. Stoner, her vehicle, who was the party
and they defended
in the accident.
They defended against her claim.
Yes.
That's the hard part for me understanding this. It seems to take it out of the norm, I guess. And again, puts us into a bit of a gray area, doesn't it? And it seems like the trial judge struggled with this. He did something seemingly unusual in trying to split the baby.
Well, and again, that is the situation of attempting to use contract principles to tort damages. I mean, we're not talking a construction case, as we saw in Royal Electric, where once you determine the contractor had substantially completed his job, the date the money became owed was clear.
And from this tort interest on, if we're talking about tort, the trial judge decided there was not bad faith by the plaintiff's insurance company in making the plaintiff go to trial to prove her damages?
Correct.
And that's a question that's not even here, right? Whether he was right or wrong about that. Okay, I think I understand the posture now. It was
again 10 years ago. The case was preceded as Nancy Stoner against Allstate. Now it is normally the uninsured motorist who is covered against the named person who is the other driver. But in this case, it proceeded directly against the company.
I guess that's an aside, but I'm just curious, how does one's insurance company, is that in the contract that your own insurance company can defend the claim?
That's in essence how it's written. In other words, that's the purpose of the uninsured motorist. Your own company has to step in and defend the tortfeasor that injured you and has the same defenses available to it that the tortfeasor would have had. So again, basically, the trial court and the Court of Appeals skipped the analysis as to whether or not this was a contract case or a tort case based on Landis. The trial court tried to apply the make-whole rule in this case, and it disallowed interest on future pain and suffering and said because those expenses had not been incurred, a logical statement. It denied interest on the medical expenses because the court found those medical expenses had been paid. In fact, they'd been paid twice, once under MedPay and a judgment for those medical expenses in the trial to the jury. The other elements of damages, pain and suffering, loss of enjoyable activities, and loss of wages, the trial court, without explanation, made the interest run from the date of the accident. Although it's obvious these damages were not all incurred on the date of the accident, and again, the plaintiff was given the opportunity to present all of her medical expenses and her complaints of pain and suffering from the date of the accident up to the date of the trial. So the jury had all of that to consider as to what those elements comprised over that 10-year span of time. And to pinpoint the date of the accident as the point at which prejudgment interest begins is without any explanation by the court or without any logic.
What do you believe, if you accept your tort version of assessing prejudgment interest, what do you believe was properly assessed prejudgment interest in this verdict?
Under Section C of the statute, there would be no interest to which the plaintiff would be entitled because there was no lack of good faith in the attempt to settle the case. The trial court used the term bad faith, which of course doesn't apply under the statute, but in essence it was a good faith finding that the offers had been made, the amount demanded was less than offered. There was no finding of what is needed under Section C of a lack of good faith.
So you would argue absence of finding of bad faith, a judgment rendered under a trial where there's disputed UM-UMC coverage, that there is no prejudgment interest to be awarded unless there's a finding of bad faith. Is that your position?
No, because the word coverage has to be taken out, and if we are disputing coverage, then I agree and the proposition is correct. That's a contract issue. If the position had been that the plaintiff was not covered at all, and in most of those cases, that determination of the amount was never an issue. It is whether there was coverage or not coverage. Once the court found coverage, then the entire amount was payable. But here, where the issue was not whether there's coverage, but simply a determination of damages, it belongs under Section C, which applies to any cases with torturous conduct.
But a court could find, you could try both those issues in one trial, could you not? Coverage and damages?
Sure.
At that point, there was no denial of coverage.
But if you had a coverage and a damage issue, and you tried them both in one trial, and the court found there was coverage and the jury determined damages, aren't you back to the same problem of where the damages began if it's a tort damage?
Well, then you do have coverage issues as to contract, as to when they would have been due and payable, and you would have the tort situation in which the damages that were awarded were tort damages. I see that you could have both an A and C claim, and some courts have mentioned that. One necessarily, just because this was a UM claim, would not mean that there couldn't have been a lack of good faith on which a judgment for prejudgment interest could have been argued under Section C. Again, the Court of Appeals then, on the other hand, approached it also again by total reference to contract cases and concluded interest had to be paid on the entire award of pain and suffering for future pain and suffering because Section A mandates that. The whole make whole rule rationale of contract prejudgment is the opposite of giving interest on money that's not even due. And finally, the Court of Appeals then allowed interest on the medical expenses that had already been paid and was paid again in the judgment. Again, in all of these situations, there is a windfall to this UM claimant that other persons injured by drivers that are insured do not enjoy. And that is one of the things that this court has changed the scope of what uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage is to provide. And it is not to provide any greater coverage than what one would expect from an insured driver.
Let me take you back to your contract argument. If you have a contract and you sue for lost profits and you get an award, do you get prejudgment interest on that whole award, or does the court separate out the future lost profits because you haven't really incurred those yet?
I would think that the court would sort that out as to that is an award of a lump sum of money now for those future damages. That the concept of making whole in that type of situation would not apply.
So you would make an assumption that they've reduced the lost profits to present value?
Yes.
Why would you not make the same assumption here?
On these tort damages, I believe that's what the jury was supposed to do. The jury was to come back with an award of damages as to a present sum for that date.
And if the present sum is reduced to present value, why isn't that interest applied to that just like it would in a contract case, if it's reduced to present value?
Because this was not a contract case, this was a tort case. So, again, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heffel. Mr. Wagner.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Prejudgment interest on uninsured motorist claims should be calculated exclusively in accordance with Section 1343.03A. This court has consistently held that uninsured, underinsured motorist claims between insurers and insureds are issues sounding in contract rather than in tort. In the seminal case, Landis versus Grange Mutual, written by Justice Piper, this court held that an uninsured, underinsured motorist claim is a contract claim and also acknowledged the fact that a UMI claim would not exist without the automobile accident. Subsection A of 1343.03 is the only subsection that refers exclusively to claims arising out of contract. Subsections B, C, and D exclusively refer to claims that arise out of tortious conduct. A UMI claim is a contract claim because the benefits, which are due and payable, are based upon an instrument of writing. And that instrument of writing is the insurance contract. Now, in the case at bar, you heard the appellant argue that the damages that were awarded to my client, the appellee, were tort damages. And I believe that is an incorrect reference. The judgment that was awarded to my client was not based on any tort claim. And Allstate Insurance Company is not a tortfeasor. The appellant is suggesting in subsection A that it only be applicable in UMI cases if the issue is contractual as to coverage.
May I ask you a different, go ahead, Justice, go ahead.
Is there something that the carrier could have done to avoid prejudgment interest or can do when these cases arise?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe the trial court has to first determine whether the case is based under subsection A or subsection C.
Well, if a UM or UIM case arises, you said the court has to determine whether it's an A case or a C case. I thought you said they were all A cases.
I believe, Your Honor, they are all A cases, but it's still left up to the trial court whether it's going to fall under subsection A or subsection C. I believe firmly that all UMI cases should be analyzed for prejudgment interest under subsection A.
Okay. Well, how much money would be due on the date of the accident in a UIM case? How would a carrier know how much money to pay?
And under those circumstances, a carrier would know as of the date of the accident how much to pay. That is correct.
So as long as it takes to litigate a case, the interest accrues until such time as the amount of the pain and suffering and the amount of the medical expenses and the amount of the all the amounts are determined, and then interest is calculated on that amount. Am I right?
That is correct, Your Honor. But
from what date?
That's the good question. And if you look at subsection A gives the trial court the discretion to determine that commencement date. And so what we have is a post-trial hearing that is held before the court, and the statute clearly gives that discretion for the commencement date. It could be the date of the accident, Your Honor.
Well, I'm reading A, and it says, unless a written contract provides a different rate of interest, and that becomes due and payable. So could a UM contract provision provide that interest will only be due once the amount is determined?
Yes.
And the contract would then eliminate any obligation of a carrier to pay prejudgment interest, or would it not?
Well, it depends upon whether a court is going to uphold the language in the policy or whether it would still adhere to the statute, 1343.03A. And subsection A, again, Your Honor, the date that prejudgment interest is to be paid when the money becomes due and payable is left up to the discretion of the trial court.
How could it be due and payable if the amount wasn't determined? It's great when you have a promissory note because you have a date certain and a sum certain, or as someone suggested earlier, contract completion date. We know when the money should have been paid. But I guess what I'm trying to probe with you is, what is your view of when that money should be due and payable? The date of the accident? Is that when you?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the trial court found that the accident date, September 11th, 1994, was the appropriate date for the commencement date. But trial courts throughout the whole state of Ohio have had different holdings for the commencement
date. What is your view?
My view, Your Honor, is that it is left up to the discretion of the trial court. I approve what the trial court did in this case as far as the commencement date. I don't agree with the reasoning of the trial court, how they got to award prejudgment interest on some damages but not on other damages. But I don't believe that I can stand before you and say that it always should be the accident date. We have to go by what the General Assembly intended. And the General Assembly gave that discretion, in my opinion, to the trial court, as Justice Pfeiffer ruled in Landis.
Thank you.
How do we square the contract decision with the fact that the contract is designed to make your client whole as if the tortfeasor had hit them, but if you allow prejudgment interest, you are getting more than you would have if you had hit somebody with insurance?
Well, that's a very good point, Your Honor. And subsection C makes a distinction on tort-based cases for prejudgment interest, how you get there by looking at the settlement negotiations of the parties. Subsection A does not require that the settlement negotiations of the parties actually be analyzed by the trial court. The point I'm getting at, Your Honor, is that we are not here to judge what the intentions of the General Assembly was, because the General Assembly under subsection A simply states that prejudgment interest is to be paid if the claim arises out of contract. So could it be conceivable that a plaintiff would recover a greater amount of money under subsection A than subsection C? And I believe a plaintiff could, because it's a more difficult burden under subsection C than subsection A, but we still have to abide by the intentions of the legislature.
Mr. Wagner, if we look at section A, could it not also mean that when the money becomes due and payable is on the date of the judgment, the court enters the judgment, and then interest runs from that point forward. So wouldn't that read out the prejudgment interest? I mean, we're talking about judgment running from the date that the damages are announced.
Are you asking, Your Honor, if a trial court could award prejudgment interest from the date of the judgment? Is that your question?
That's my question.
And I think absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, I think that many courts throughout Ohio have ruled as such. This trial court did not in this case.
Isn't there precedent from this court, though, that that it's not from the date of judgment, but in fact, as in the Landis case says, when it was due and payable, which the implication at least is it's always before the date of judgment?
I believe, Your Honor, in accordance with Landis, the issue of the commencement date was obviously remanded to the trial court and left up to the trial court when that date could be. I'm not clear whether it could not necessarily be the date of judgment. I believe that the discretion per the statute does give the trial court that authority. And so I believe that it could conceivably be the date of the judgment. There's been other appellate decisions that have found as such. And I believe there's also been decisions whereby in UMI cases, they go back not to the date of the accident, but to the date in which uninsured, underinsured motorist was demanded. And so I think there could be a myriad of different dates, but I do believe that the date of judgment could conceivably be the date. In this case, the trial court was not clear as to whether prejudgment interest was awarded to the appellee in accordance with subsection A or C. The trial court found that underinsured motorist benefits was based in contract, which would seem to indicate that it relied upon subsection A. The trial court also considered the settlement demand of the appellee, which would seem to indicate that it was possibly relying upon subsection C. In any event, the appellate court correctly reversed the trial court, which failed to award prejudgment interest on my client's judgment, which related to her medical expenses. And the appellate court relied upon this court's holdings in Shear versus Motors Mutual and Grange Mutual versus Lindsay. And in those cases, this court held that uninsured motorist coverage cannot be diminished by payments made to the insured pursuant to the medical payments provision of the same contract of insurance. In this case, the appellee is correct, as it was stated in its brief, and also an argument, the appellee could in essence have a double recovery of her medical expenses. However, there were separate insurance premiums paid for those coverages, for uninsured motorist coverage as well as for the medical payments provision. And this court has, in the Grange Mutual versus Lindsay decision, referenced an Arizona Supreme Court decision, Bacchus versus Farmers Insurance Group, which held, and I quote, "The medical payment coverage part of the policy is independent of the uninsured motorist coverage and should be treated the same as if it were carried with a different company," end of quote. The appeals court also reversed the trial court, which failed to award prejudgment interest on my client's future pain and suffering damages. Subsection A provides for prejudgment interest on all judgments arising out of contract. It does not give a trial court the authority to decide which types of damages should be subjected to prejudgment interest.
Are you aware of any cases in contract where a trial judge separated out lost profits and did not award that part of the judgment, prejudgment interest?
No, Your Honor. I believe, in fact, when you posed the question to appellant's counsel in that hypothetical case, I believe that if a matter is based in contract and subsection A of 1343.03 applies, and if some of those profits are future profits, I believe that subsection A must award prejudgment interest on those future profits. Subsection C has specific language which precludes prejudgment interest on future damages. But that language is not contained in subsection A. So I believe to comply with the clear language of the General Assembly, I believe future damages can, in fact, be subjected to prejudgment interest under subsection A.
Mr. Wagner, we're talking about prejudgment interest under A, and yet it seems to me that the prejudgment interest section is C. I mean, because C is separated into various parts. And if you look at A, we're talking about interest that runs from the date of judgment, which means forward. So A to me, and unless I'm missing something, A to me means we're talking about the interest that is awarded as of the date that the court enters its judgment. The amount of money plus interest from the time until it's collected. Now, if we talk about the failure to perform in good faith and so on, you may have the prejudgment interest under C, under Section C, and it may involve a contract situation if, for example, you know, the court finds that there was failure to settle in good faith, for example. But aren't we kind of mixing things up when we talk about prejudgment and A in the same sentence?
Well, in all due respect, Your Honor, I do not agree with your opinion. I believe that subsection A is earmarked specifically for prejudgment interest.
Where specifically does it say that in subsection A?
Okay. In the beginning of subsection A, it refers to when money becomes due and payable. And then it says, upon any, and it goes on, instrument of writing. And it's been held by various courts that an instrument of writing can very much equate to an insurance policy. And then it goes on and says, and upon all judgments, and then it goes on, for the payment of money arising out of contract. And then it says, the creditor is entitled to interest. So subsection A is again specifically for contract cases. Subsection C is for tort-based cases. But I do believe clearly that prejudgment interest is awarded under subsection A, and this court held as such in Landis.
Although, and I know that the title of a statute is not part of our statutory interpretation, but we're talking about non-stipulated rates. This section is not entitled prejudgment interest.
Correct. There are non-stipulated rates. That's correct, Your Honor. If I may close.
Very quickly.
To the best of my knowledge, no court in the state of Ohio has ever ruled consistent with the appellant's argument. When applying Section 1343.03 to a determination of prejudgment interest, a trial court must first decide whether the case is based in contract or based in tort. If the trial court decides that the case is based in contract, subsection A applies. In that situation, the trial court is not afforded the discretion as to whether or not to award prejudgment interest.
You need to sum up, Mr. Wagner.
Yes, it must be awarded because of the statutory language of the creditors entitled to interest. The statute does not afford a trial court the opportunity to apply both subsections A and C, as the appellant is arguing in this case. We would request respectfully that the appellate court decision be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Mr. Heffel, you saved 2 minutes of your time.
Is it possible to rule that although this contract action, this action is based on contract, the damages are based on tort? Is that essentially your position?
Essentially, the determination was a tort determination. It looked like a tort case. It was tried like a tort case. The issues were, what were the medical expenses, what were the lost wages, what were the pain and suffering? Therefore, it was a tort case. The statute itself is amended in 1994, and Section C got amplified. It says that it applies to a civil action that is based on tortuous conduct. Well, this was a civil action, and the issue that was tried to the jury was the tortuous conduct and the damages.
A also refers to tortuous conduct. Nobody mentioned that, but it refers to tortuous conduct or contract, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Justice Lanzinger's observation aside, I think she's got a pretty good point but about statutory interpretation, but it says tortuous conduct also.
And again, I believe that's read in the context of you can have a tort in a contract case, such as a construction case, where there is a failure to perform or negligence in the performance of the contract. But C itself is so specific, and that's why I say, first of all, if we go back to Makovitz and look at the history of what was to be accomplished, and that is under contract to make whole and under tort to punish for delay, we see those very concepts enumerated in the statute as it now stands. And in particular, subsection C says you shall not award damages on future damages. You shall not award interest on future damages. And finally, then, this again brings up the situation where the uninsured motorist is provided with greater benefits than one who is in an accident with one who is insured. And for those three reasons, the proposition of law should be upheld.
Thank you, Mr. Heffel. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.